and I was looking for folks who were doing book art in Florence, and Patricia's name kept popping up, but I didn't know Patricia. I figured out a way to acquire her email address and sent an email and said, "You don't know me, but could we have coffee? I think we might have a few things in common."
She stalked me, in other words.
And we sat down. She graciously agreed to do that. We sat down for maybe 30 minutes, we thought, mm-hmm. coffee, and three hours.
30 minutes.
Yeah, something like that. 3 hours later, we
got
stood
up.
Said, "You know, I think we have more to say. Maybe we even have something to do together." And we continued those coffee dates for a while. Mm-hmm. And the idea of collaboration percolated.
I think you came up with this idea, and you suggested it often to me, and I resisted. And you kept suggesting, and I kept resisting, until finally I said, "Okay, let's give this a try, or else this woman's never going to leave me alone."
And I don't know what led me to do that, maybe just intuition. I was probably also looking for creative community, having recently moved to Florence, and not really, I didn't know too many folks there at that point. It's hard to break into the Florentine Florence. They're sort of would you say the kind of Parisians of Italy?
Yes, it's a very kind of closed society, I think. You grow up in Florence, you make friends from when you were a child, and you keep them, and it's hard to kind of break through that sort of crust to get in there and really become part of the society there. So it is hard.
Maybe because they are historically the bankers of Italy, I don't know. But nevertheless, I was looking for certainly creative community, and book art is my thing. So collaboration, the idea percolated, and we needed to come up with a way to collaborate. And so Patricia sort of said, "Well, it would be nice and neat if we started this at sort of January 1, and we had these kind of parameters," and I think this was somewhere February, March, and I thought, well, I can't possibly wait another 10 months. So our next coffee date, I came to the meeting with a sheet of guidelines.
Yes. She had it all planned out, so I could not back away. It's like, okay, she's got it all worked out. I guess I'm doing this.
So I said, "Let's try this, and if it doesn't work, we'll do something different." But we ended up going with that, and that was...
What was interesting is that the way we collaborated, I'm a printmaker, so in printmaking, oftentimes you do collaborations. You do suites of an edition of prints where each printmaker will be... Well, everyone will be given a theme, and each printmaker does a print based on that theme. So that is one type of collaboration. That's sort of a common collaboration. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted to do something slightly different, something that really became an intertwining, I guess, of our efforts. Not, you know, you do one part, I do one part, we put it together, and that's it. We wanted it to be almost seamless, the way the collaboration came together. So why don't you explain, Lyle, a little bit how it worked?
So I think we all, as artists, have things in our studios that they still kind of hold a sort of energy or curiosity, but we haven't really worked it out, or they haven't made it into a work of ours, and yet they still sit in some drawer or on some tabletop. And assuming that Patricia had that too,
I'm a pack rat, so I definitely have that.
So the idea was that we would come to the beginning of a collaboration, the starting artist, and the starting artist would alternate each project. So I started the first one. So I would come to the collaboration with starting materials, and I would have to have enough to make ultimately two book art, an edition of two book art books, so that they had to be essentially the same. So I needed to have at least two of whatever these...
Two sets of materials.
Some materials, beginning materials, and an inspiration. And the inspiration could be a quote, it could be a passage from a book, it could be a photograph,
anything.
An idea. Yep. And in this case, so our first book is called The Things That Ride Out Time. And the quote was about an object. It was from Alice McDermott's book, Charming Billy. And it's about this passage is about a glass juicer, just a simple mundane object, but that sort of had ridden out time in this particular character's life. And there it was still in his kitchen after having been through moves and different boxes. And so sort of this idea of the mundane that rides out time, and what is the value of that, or, you know, how to look at those objects. And as to kind of expats, and having packed up certainly both of us many times in our lives and moved overseas back and forth, what are those objects? Do they have meaning? What is the meaning? How are they connected to who we are? And what will ultimately ride out time, both the objects, but then more sort of broadly mm-hmm. memory. And mm-hmm. so I brought these materials with that inspiration, and then the idea is that she could edit, of course, the materials and add naturally, but that we would sort of stay true to the impetus of the project.
Yeah, and you know, this being the first book collaboration that we did, you know, we tended to meet at cafes in Florence, sit over coffee and do our exchanges. So she brought the stuff, and I'm looking at it when I got home, and I'm like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with this? I have no idea. First of all, because I knew very little about her previous artwork. She knew probably nothing about my artwork. We had never collaborated before. And there was this very real sense of obligation, you know, that I wanted to do something that would be worthy of this person and this person's investment of time and her aesthetic, which I didn't know. So it was very kind of intimidating. And it also, the idea was that once I received the materials, I would begin working and putting together a project, but I would only take it to a halfway point. So I wouldn't do a completed project. I would take it halfway. And at that halfway point, which tended to be, in theory, around 2 weeks, I would hand it back to Lyle. And then she would have an additional roughly 2 weeks to complete the project. So she would get it halfway done, or not, depending on what she decided to do with it. But also just defining that, how much is halfway? How much am I contributing too much or not giving her enough space for her voice?
And how did you know that? I mean, at what point did you decide that for yourself?
It was very tough because, you know, I didn't know how much she was expecting, how much, again, as I said, I didn't want to step on her toes and not give her any space to do anything. What I ended up doing for this first one, she had given me these photographs that had been printed on folded sheets of paper. So I ended up sort of inventing this sort of stitching, not binding the pages together, but kind of stitching them sort of together. And the things she had given me sort of, they were like scraps of paper and little pieces of this and that. And I went through lots of different ideas of what I could do, somehow creating some sort of collage or, and ultimately I ended up sort of this idea that it felt like a quilt where you take little scraps of things and you put it together. So I ended up intervening into the materials with a lot of stitching, a lot of sort of decorative stitching and piercing holes that suggested stitching even though the threads weren't there. And I sort of bound it together roughly, not completely, and reached the point and I said, okay, I'm going to stop here because I don't want to take it so far that then she can't introduce her own sort of ideas. And then I handed it back to her.
So there was a level of respect you were giving her with her creative endeavors.
Absolutely.
And really giving that space to her.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a sense of giving, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Of allowing yourself to stop and know and trust.
Exactly. And it's also very much a sense of letting go. Because as I work, I tend to work for certain things in my own personal work, in printmaking. Sometimes there are especially certain techniques in printmaking where you have to plan ahead very mm-hmm. carefully. So you have to know the steps that you're going to be following in order to achieve your vision. There's other techniques in printmaking that are much more fluid, sort of like monoprint being one type of, where you begin, you work, and then you see what comes out and you react to it. So there's this very real sense of this. And that's how I began this project with the stitching, was just kind of going for it because I thought about it. We tended to do this. We would get the stuff and we had about 2 weeks. We would think for about 12 days, and then all of a sudden, last 2 days, all of a sudden, and that's what I had reached, and I was like, okay, I just got to do it, and I started doing the stitching, and I liked what I had come up with, and I was handing it back to her. So you were saying there was this trust, but there was also this letting go,
right?
Because she could, once she received it, she could do anything she wanted to it. She could take apart everything I did. She'd take off all the stitching and whatever, and so there's this sort of dual letting go and trust also. That came. It was things that we really learned throughout this process.
Mm-hmm. And I think you said that it was like a giving, which that's so interesting because when this, I very vividly remember the moment that I received this particular book, and it was like Christmas.
Yeah.
And this was March. I think it was March. And I had this, it was just the most amazing moment to meet in this cafe and to know that these objects were going to be revealed to me. And I had no idea what she'd done with this inspiration, these original materials. And I was speechless. I absolutely was in awe of what she'd done. I thought it was stunning. I felt no I could take no credit for that. I had simply given her the original, you know, materials. And I just had these tinglings of this is so meant to be, that I met this person and we're going to make these things. And you took the
action to make it happen too.
Yes.
I mean, that's important to acknowledge, again, right?
I feel that was so intuitive. Who knew? I really had never seen anything. And I did try to look up work she'd done, but I couldn't find anything. So I really knew nothing about her work.
I'm very hidden on the web.
I mean, you just went with your gut. I mean, you guys just met each other, and it was just a shot in the dark of, well, this feels right. Yeah. Let's just do something. And you did it.
When she said she felt intimidated, you know, when she first got the materials, well, how did I feel when I received this beautiful...
How did you feel?
I thought, I can't possibly touch this. This is exquisite. It's done. Why? It's more than halfway done. But then, you know, you take that home and you meditate and you sort of you touch
meditate
the book
for a long
and you
time.
Think, okay, I have to intervene on this thing, and I really had to think go back to the inspiration and what is this project? What do we want it to say? What are we trying to really, you know? And I think we speak a certain Bookart language or visual language. But not everybody speaks that language. So we can't assume that you will pick up that book, for example, as she brought it to the halfway point, and you'll have that experience. It still needed that extra thing that would really help the reader, viewer, engage with it in the way that we really intend. Not that there's a there's a conclusion. I think a lot of the books we make is ask questions, and they present.
And they leave things open-ended for the viewer to be able to experience and to come to conclusions or come to more questions of their own. That's, I think, important to both of us in our work.
We're not telling you what to think. Yeah. We're just showing you.
We're not doing manifestos.
No. So I bravely decided, we need to actually tell a story. So I wrote the text for this. And for example, Patricia had included in materials added to that particular project these tissue paper bits of tissue paper and wanting to stay true to, I don't want to go out and find more tissue paper like that. And I think it was even old tissue paper.
It was kind of like the tracing paper that architects use, the very thin sort
yellowy
kind of, yeah.
So I decided I was going to limit myself to those bits. So the writing had to fit times two, because addition of two on these bits. So they're these kind of differing sizes of tissue papers on which the text appears throughout the books, which again I thought fit nicely with this idea of remnant and these things that we cherish but that may be partial or, you know, have been
written. And also, it's nice, oftentimes it's nice because there's multiple sort of connections with, like, even the tissue material, it's also reflective of the idea. I mean, a lot of it was these things that get passed on. It dealt with, you know, you're moving and you're wrapping up your precious objects in tissue paper to go into the next move. So all of a sudden the text is on this tissue paper. So there's all these sort of like levels and layers of meaning that one can
And attachments too.
Exactly.
And stories within those objects themselves that we attribute to.
And book art is, I think that should be said, because we take for granted the materials a book artist chooses, that those choices become very important. We want the materials to really become one with the content. So the material choices and the structure we make become critical to the meaning that we're trying to deliver. So for example, that book and that structure worked very well for that content. Well, the very next book, we made a game. We ended up making a game. It looks absolutely nothing like the first book. And we should say that, you know, we intended to not, we weren't trying to go for a unified grouping of projects that all looked kind of by the...
Did we say that we ended up making 12?
No, we didn't. We haven't said that.
12 books in total. At a certain point, I think after the first couple of ones, we decided, okay, let's go. You know, this seems to be working. This is interesting. We're creating things that are interesting, but also I think we were learning things. Let's try to make this, you know, a grouping of 12. And in theory, it was going to be in 1 year.
Impossible.
How long did you start this process?
March 2014.
14.
Okay.
So it's been 3 years.
Yeah, it's been
well,
3 years.
Part of that was interrupted by the fact that I moved back to the U.S. And so we couldn't have our weekly coffee anymore.
Which was very important to the creative process.
It's coffee shops.
Exactly.
Right. Speak a little bit to the fact that we weren't, again, it was an exploratory. We weren't looking for a stamp on each book.
Because the, as Lyle was saying, the second book took on this sort of format of a game, and I was the one who originated the materials, giving the materials. And I very specifically went through my hordes of things in my studio and picked out things. The first book, again, it's hard to not be able to see it, but the colors were very muted. It was a very kind of soft, tenuous sort of look to the book, you know, with these very... the tissue papers that were, you know, almost floated as you turned the pages. It was something very kind of calming to it. The second book, I picked the most jarring colored things I could find, these bright yellow things. I had taken photographs some years before at this abandoned sort of carnival in Milan. So it's these very bright, you know, the rides with all the colors and the numbers. And I handed this to her because I very distinctly wanted it to be something completely different. I didn't want to make 12 books that all looked the same. So I gave her those things and said, go for it.
Right. So again, we were not thinking ever, oh, we're going to exhibit these one day.
No.
Or this is part of some finish line.
You're just having fun.
Yes.
We're just exploring. And trying to, realizing, wow, this little community of two is becoming so much bigger than what either one of us could have done alone. And let's see where that takes us.
But I think also there was something to be learned of the fact that, you know, even though I talked earlier about, you know, feeling nervous about me creating something that was worthy of my partner. But I think as an artist, and especially I teach university students, and I see it with young artists, there's this nervousness of creating something that's worthy of the public. With these projects early on, there was none of that because it was an exercise. In my mind, it was an exercise. So if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't. Lyle was the only one who was going to see it. So it didn't really matter. So there was this liberating feeling to it. I was allowed to experiment. I was allowed to explore, and I was allowed to mess up. You know, nobody was going to kill me. I mean, maybe she was going to kill me, but we could also just, you know, dump that project because nobody, you know, it was something between the two of us.
Right.
That slowly, as we saw that, whether it was because of the sort of loose and open approach to the work, that things were coming out that were interesting, that we wanted to share with other people. It was interesting for me anyway. The dynamic changed a little bit. The more we started seeing, oh, this is cool. Oh, and then Lyle, of course, says, oh, we should exhibit this. We should make a catalog. We should do that.
I need to say here, because you're saying I was intimidated by Lyle and this and that.
I was.
Okay. Patricia is so humble. I have to say, I have watched now her abilities, her ideas, her, expertise, and I remain in awe and such deep respect for her, all of what I just said. And so it's been a true honor and privilege of my life to have worked with her.
I paid her to say that.
it's not ending here. It's not as if we're done, but I do, it's been such a privilege. So that intuition that led me to her early on, has been, you know, really, maybe selfish.
It's a fascinating story. I mean, here you meet at a coffee shop. Mm-hmm. You have this gut feeling that maybe there's something there. You guys start playing with paper and stitching and ideas and stories. And here you are a few years later in San Francisco about to present an exhibit of work. Mm-hmm. And it's a great journey.
It is a journey.
It really. And exactly to be able to share that with other people as a story. Mm-hmm. We were talking before the show about this invisible space that gets created when two people work collaboratively together that you might have experienced. Can you speak to that? Because that's interesting.
I think I was sort of thinking about just the final product of these books. I could never have made any one of those books, and I think you would say the same.
No, way. I would absolutely.
So that's what I meant. There's this third thing happens. This creation of this, in our case, objects. That really transcends our individual even abilities. And I think, and we were sort of touching on this earlier, before the show, that could be applied to many other areas. That could be applied to lots of places that could use some growth right now. But again, as Patricia said, it involves letting go of control, letting go of even your own vision and ideas. It involves trusting.
Yeah, I was going to say, it does, for me specifically, it involved a lot of trusting. Lyle's work, her book works that she's done in the past, a lot of them deal with sort of very, I always make fun of these very heavy topics, whereas my work tended to be less so, to say the least. And for several of the books where I would hand over the projects and all of a sudden, you know, she would hand it back to me and all of a sudden I'm having to deal with, you know, a book about, you know, organ trafficking or immigration crisis in Europe or, you know, all these very heavy topics. And for me, there had to really be this idea of trust that all of a sudden she's dragging me, kicking and screaming into these areas that for me were very scary, you know. And it's, you know, as you were saying earlier, it's part of the world now that we have a lot of these scary situations that are happening. And so it was forcing me to really kind of stop and think about it and confront it and, you know, create something that dealt with those questions. Again, we tend not to create books that, you know, have answers. They usually have more questions at the end of the, than anything else.
Well, you rose to the occasion, of course.
Well, I don't know about
every
that.
Time.
But anyway.
And again, did things that I could never have come up with. And for example, in the book Paper Boats, mm-hmm. which we show in the San Francisco exhibit, and then we, in fact, expanded upon somewhat. We created a couple of cases where we grew the book into a kind of wall installation. But that, you ended up creating and finding more community around that book mm-hmm. than I...
Yeah, that book in particular was, I guess I originated the materials on mm-hmm. that, and I gave Lyle a stack of basically origami paper, you know, little squares of origami paper, and I forgot, maybe some other paper. Ticket stubs, these little blank ticket stubs from, I had found on the street in Florence from the Franciscan Order of something or other.
It was like these little names.
Yeah, for names. It was like presents, like, mm-hmm. you know, I guess people came and... You got a little ticket if you showed up to the meeting or something. I'm not sure. You find very interesting things in the streets in Florence.
and it's all art. I mean, you can create an expression from
That's
it.
That's why I have so much stuff in my studio, because I pick it up off the street.
And you see
the
potential in all of this or a feeling.
Exactly.
Or
another thing was some photographs you'd taken of prayer papers.
Oh, yeah. And the inspiration were these photographs I had taken in Japan, in Kyoto, of these sort of folded papers that they use at... temples, I guess. They're like prayers that people fold and hang on things, and I think some folded paper cranes mm-hmm. and things mm-hmm. like that. And that was the inspiration. Mm-hmm. So I gave it to her, and then she comes back the next time with these two gigantic boxes filled with 200 folded paper boats. She had taken all of those little paper squares and folded 200 little boats.
Yeah.
And on the tickets, she had printed... this was, again, in Europe, I don't know how well in the news it is here, but the immigration crisis in the Mediterranean is a tragic situation, and there's thousands and thousands of people coming across, especially from Libya and those areas, coming across the Mediterranean on these rickety boats to try to make it to Italy to eventually make it into Europe. And so, again, the theme became this idea of this immigration crisis, which was something that Lyle had been dealing with already. And...
So the tickets.
Oh, the tickets then, she had printed, she had looked up names of mainly North African.
African and
Middle Eastern.
Eastern
and
Eastern European
names, Eastern. Typical names, and she had printed on them, and in addition she had put a number. So it was basically sort of the ticket of admission of these immigrants coming into Europe.
Uh-huh.
The numbers ranged from, you know, one to a million. Mm-hmm.
Because that year, a million.
Yeah, the year we had done that, about a million people had immigrated in this way into mm-hmm. Europe. So anyway, so I get these little tickets and I get these boats and I'm like, now what? I have, you know, this giant box of 200 boats. You know, I can't really make it into a book. You know, I can't bind them together. I mean, I could. I thought about it in many different ways. So instead, what I decided to do is I went out on the street with this box and I started stopping people on the street and saying, would you mind picking a boat out of the box and holding it in your hands and I will take a picture. And I took a picture, just all you can see is really their hands holding the boat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not their faces, nothing like that. And they just hold one boat. They could hold it however they wanted to, with one hand, two hands, whatever. And they could pick whatever boats they wanted. And just stopped 100 people.
And were you selective in the type of person you stopped?
I mean, no, not really. I mean, I did, you know, some people were people I knew, like at the school, I would have some students. I had my boss in his, you know, suit. I had, you know, the Senegalese street vendor that is always outside the bar I go to in the morning. I had the Albanian concertina player that's on the street. I had, you know, anybody. I tried to get a real different mix of people,
mm-hmm.
And took 100 photos, you know, one for each boat.
Because I made 200, because again, two sets.
Yes.
So the idea was 100.
And yeah, 100, 100, one for each. And took the series. So it became, the book eventually became this sort of photo documentary where as you flip through it, it's just, there's no, very little text. We'll talk about the text in a minute. But it's just this kind of litany of these 100 hands holding these 100 boats.
Wow.
You know, this idea of embracing or not these immigrants that are coming in.
The faces.
Oh yeah, and I also, a few people I asked if they would be willing to have me photograph their face, sort of like a mugshot. And I photographed some, and then in Photoshop I scanned in those tickets and I put that across their eyes, basically. So you really, you know, you could only sort of make them out. You could, and they became these mugshots that periodically show up in the book.
And again, those tickets only have first names. And my idea in printing that was to speak to this really tragic loss of identity that's taking place. And so she then framed it with this kind of mugshot, which was really perfect. By the way, we don't really tell each other what we're intending.
Yeah.
And we don't say, oh, and I really want you to do this to finish it.
No.
You know, or,
wow.
And we also hand it off with no information.
Yeah, we don't talk about, also, while we're working on it, we don't say, oh, this is what I'm doing, how I'm developing this. Occasionally, we'll get a question from the other one, such as, one time I got a request from Patricia, I need a mugshot of you. That wasn't this book, by the way. That was another book. And then a profile, too.
Yeah.
And so I had no idea, you know, what that was for.
Wow.
I get the picture
yeah,
taken.
You get these
I get
bizarre
my
questions.
Taken,
yeah.
Know,
which so, really allows it to be open.
Yes.
And well, endless.
And we don't want to direct the other one, right?
Mm.
Which one would have a tendency to do. But again, it's that letting go of control.
Right.
And so
you guys are rebels.
And yet, it was as if she knew, I mean, just in those little tickets with a first name and a number, she knew exactly what I was sort of getting at, and she then did it, you know, much better than I could have. So the book is punctuated with those.
Yes, and then also I had a little book that I carried with me, and I asked each person I photographed if they would like to write anything, you know, just their impressions on the immigrant. I tried to phrase it in a way that wouldn't, you know, influence them on what they're writing. It's like, do you have any thoughts on the immigration situation? And a lot of people didn't, but, you know, I probably got about a third of the people did, and they would write little phrases. So in the book, the final book, I included probably about 25 of those quotes of, and, you know, they kind of, the gamut. Again, I wasn't looking to do a manifesto on, you know, the immigration from one point of view or the other. So some of the quotes are definitely not crazy about the immigration situation, slightly negative towards it, and others are more positive, and that's what I wanted. I wanted it to be a sort of
documentary.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and people who look at it, they can, you know, come to their own conclusions or come up with their own questions about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. I say rebel, and why am I saying that? Because it sounds like you guys are going counter to so many things that people are educated to do. You know, one is being directive and you know, being a director, having a vision and implementing that vision versus just letting go and allowing what arise. Mm-hmm. And really just the trusting aspect of giving up something that you preciously worked on to let it just go and have a life out there and between the two of you.
Maybe, it's our age too.
Maybe, but the other thing I hear the both of you doing is, you know, rather than talking about yourself, you're like uplifting each other. You know, you keep complimenting and seeing what was valuable in the other person that helped you yourself. Mm-hmm. Which I'm hearing you guys go back and forth, which I find really interesting.
I didn't pick up that.
Yeah.
Well, I do. I mean, like I said, I have so much respect for Patricia, and we just did something. We just changed our format a little bit because we were invited to have a residency in Florence this past spring, and then have an exhibit of the work we created in the residency. So we worked quite differently. Mm-hmm. In that case, we both occupied essentially a gallery for 2 weeks and then created a show that was put up in the gallery. So we were kind of in a fishbowl on a street storefront or gallery front in Florence, so people could watch us working potentially, and then working side by side, which was quite different. And
it still had this idea. I mean, we were still trying to work with the idea of collaboration. But in this instance, we were trying to expand it between a collaboration, not just between the two of us, but a collaboration with the public. So the way it actually began was we sent out a call for people to donate stuff. and we kind of gave it a general theme. The theme was nostalgia. And we said, anything that you want to contribute, relating to nostalgia, you know, drop it off at the gallery by this date, and then starting on this date, we will be in the gallery from morning till night working, creating the work. So we were actually creating the work, you know, in situ, in there, where it was going to be eventually exhibited. And we, again, we had this limited amount of time, just like with the books. We only had 10 days, was it? Something like that, 10 days to actually create all the work to fill a gallery. And we ended up getting, you know, all sorts of stuff from people, just strangest things that came in. And the first day, I remember we walked into the gallery and there was, on this table, there was all this stuff laid out. And I'm like, oh my goodness.
I think 42 people gave us at least 10 to 100 things each.
Yeah.
From postcards to clothes to perfume bottles,
to Barbie dolls, cameras, to
shot glasses,
Time magazines from the 60s, and all sorts of things.
They weren't going to get these things back. So they didn't give us perhaps their most precious objects of nostalgia. However, many of them, well, I should say every single one of them came with a story.
Yes.
And I think we didn't realize, I didn't realize when I first started collecting things, because I collected a few things in the U.S. before getting to Florence. Every single person wanted to tell me the story of these objects.
Yeah.
And I suddenly realized this is going to be as much about collecting these stories as it is collecting these objects.
Yeah.
And because of that, I think maybe it was really was that more, it wasn't so much the intrinsic value of the objects, because we also quickly learned that, you know, your objects of the nostalgia are only really intrinsically valuable to you.
To yourself.
I mean, they don't really hold intrinsic value for others, right? But because of the value placed upon them through these stories and these connections people had to them, we very quickly realized, oh, you know what? We're not going to be cutting any of this stuff up. We are not going to be deconstructing.
Which was the assumption. I think we had that assumption, but I think also the public, knowing that we were book artists, assumed that we were going to be taking apart these things and, you know, using them as physical material to just kind of create new books. And yeah, very early on, as we're sitting the first day in the gallery, we're like, no, we can't do that. You know, how can we take that apart? You know, it felt almost like an invasion, you know.
Right.
So we needed to somehow make those objects valuable to us, to kind of make them ours. And we probably talked for two days straight before we
started doing anything.
And we ultimately ended up recombining, or rather creating combinations of a sort of collection of objects that became
still lives.
Still life. So we decided we wanted to use at least one thing from every person who donated in this collection of what became 8 still lifes. And so every person's represented. And then those still lifes really took on, they became these, we were engaged with the beauty of these objects together, and we really put them together as a kind of a sculpture. I mean, as a formally pleasing and sort of
harmonious. And there was different criteria that just sort of we didn't discuss, okay, let's on this sculpture or in this still life, let's talk, you know, let's concentrate on, you know, forms, or in this one in color. No, it just sort of naturally happened that way, that certain ones, the forms became very important. Other ones, the tonality or the colors became very important. Other ones, there were sort of subtle themes that went through. Mm-hmm. And it was all very sort of organic. I mean, it just sort of flowed together.
And we created those together. I was sort of trying to think. I can't really remember who did what. We just, and that was, again, we didn't have to say a lot. It was kind of like, oh yeah, over there. We wouldn't really finish a sentence, and then one of us would go get the object that was needed in that corner or whatever. So
once we finished these 8 still lives that eventually were placed on these sort of shelves all along the walls of the gallery, it felt like, I think it was probably because we are book artists, it felt like it was, I mean, they were interesting. They were interesting to look at. They were sort of fascinating, and you could kind of get lost in them, but it felt like there was still something missing. At that point, you know, we both looked at each other and said, text. It needs text.
Mm.
So we sort of sat in front of them and meditated and let the now new collection of objects speak to us and tell us its story. And by the way, the whole time we had been inventorying every single piece of paper and everything that came through, and there were hundreds, so we had this list. So this idea of inventorying these objects, and again, the stuff of our lives, right? And so the person, the name attached to each object became part of the story that the new collection had to tell. So the texts that emerged were 8 kind of poetic texts that do each includes each donor's name and their object, so that the inventory is woven into the poetic text. And those lived on a shelf in kind of folders, so that you would experience the still life, and then it had a number next to it, and you would go get the numbered folder, and then you would have this now new experience, or, you know, whatever the order. But you had a kind of a textual experience as well as this physical, visual experience.
And those who donated the objects, were they there for the final show?
Many were. Mm-hmm. I mean, some were in the U.S.
I think most of the ones who were in Florence, yes. But yeah. I think, yeah, the ones in the States weren't.
I would be curious to hear what their reactions were, you know, because it sounds like these were sacred objects. I mean, if you want to attach that word to it. I mean, we have stuff in our life everywhere, but the story is something they're so attached to, something that is so meaningful to be made into a creation that has artistic value beyond what an individual has, which you guys created for them.
They certainly became important to us.
Yeah. Well, and it also harkens back to the first book we talked about earlier had the text from Alex McDermott about the juicer.
Yes.
Which is just, I mean, you know, how many little things like that do we have in our kitchen or in wherever?
In these days, people have a lot of things.
Exactly. And we do too. But it's surprising what can, even just sort of insignificant things that you don't really place value on, can hold meaning.
Yes.
You know, and have stories.
Yeah. Yeah, we give them meaning, don't we? And wow, I'd love to, let's take a break. And during this break, we have also something to share. Your husband, Lyle, Francesco Roncotti.
Ronchetti.
The Italian. I have to confess, I've known Lyle for 20 years, 15 years, a number of years. And I've seen her go through life as an artist, as a mother, as a wife, many, many different ways. And so it's really fun to have her here in this show.
It's great to see you.
It's great. And Francesco, I know as well. And he is just full of life, a huge spirit. And he's also a musician. I've seen him play once or twice here in the San Francisco Bay. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about what he's up to these days and what we're about to hear.
Well, he is, speaking of collaboration, really had been having a beautiful experience around collaboration in the States in the last couple of years.
He's originally from Florence.
He is, yes, Florentine. I met him in Florence in 1992, I believe, 91. Mm. And I think you have some music which harkens back to an earlier collaboration. He worked with two musicians in Florence for years and years on a project called Trinovox, where they composed original music to pre-existing poems, and they sang in the language of the poem. So, you know, one would think, oh my goodness, they speak 12 languages. Well, no, not exactly, but they would. It was quite an intellectual project where they would at least learn to, you know, pronounce and the meaning of what they were singing, certainly. But they wanted to stay true to the origins of the writing. And that...
And a lot of this was pre-Christian texts, I understand, right?
Yeah, it was really broad. I mean, the first album was largely Dante, the Inferno. So... It was quite an interesting research project, and I think a little bit connecting to what Patricia and I were saying about the broad nature of the forms our books have taken. So a game to a more of a nostalgic type of book to this music, Trinovox's music, does sort of cross genres and epochs, and it's very eclectic in a certain way. And so that is, I think, that's what he was doing in Italy for many years. And now he's been working with actually an author in Virginia who's a psychiatrist who wrote a book about coincidence. And it's called Connecting with Coincidence. And Francesco has put to music many of these stories around coincidence, which are just fascinating. This man, Dr. Bernie Beitman, is also known as Dr. Coincidence. And the stories are wonderful. And so... Francesco has made what I think are just beautiful songs using his lyrics. We don't have any of that right now because that is being recorded as we speak. But there's some of his earlier Italian trio music.
So this is Trinovox off the Incanto album, mm-hmm. CD. And let's see, we've got two here. Maybe Canción de Jinete, which is in Spanish. Gosh, we'll have to find out what the lyrics are. Okay, well, let's listen to some music, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with Lyle and Patricia for more talk on book arts and writing and collaboration and more. All right, here we go. Music. That's by Trina Vox, Lyle's husband, Francesco
Ronchetti.
Ronchetti.
That's how we say it in America anyway.
From Florida. Ronchetti. I got to get the Italian down here. Worked on that for a few years. Wow. So we're back here on Take Back with Lyle Harris and Patricia Silva, two women who had met in Florence about 3 years ago and have been creating these magical, beautiful works of art, books, beautiful books. And they will be presenting an exhibit at the San Francisco Public Library. That actually started June 10th, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk about more of that in just a moment. But we were just talking off air about the importance of book arts, and because it's really risen, it's really become a profound... profound art.
Art practice.
Art practice. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's the word I needed to hear. And in a world where some claim we are losing art books, you guys are really taking this art to a whole nother experiential level, art level, and more. And I had hoped that you could talk about that a little bit, about the book arts. What's happening after listening to your incredible adventure? And I mean, it's an incredible adventure that the two of you have been on to create something so magical.
Well, what's interesting is that, excuse me, is that we chose to do this, or we didn't choose, but it just happened to be that we were doing this in Florence, Italy, which, you know, even though there's been this revival in the past, I don't know, what, 30 years here in America around book arts, in Italy, that's not true. It's still something that's very, very unknown, even in art circles. So it was sort of a double challenge for us to create this there and actually find an audience that could
respond
to it. Yeah. which was very interesting.
I think also, what are you going to teach a master bookbinder in Florence?
Yeah.
We met with Enrico Giannini, a fabulous, amazing craftsperson.
Seventh generation.
I think he's fifth. But yeah, his daughter's now sixth.
Oh, yeah.
Bookbinder in Florence who could do anything, right?
Yeah.
I don't think he would call himself, he's not a book artist, though. He's really a craftsperson extraordinaire. Mm-hmm. And so when you know, I go in with my book that I'm binding, I mean, I can't even show Enrico my book. You know, it's not, I mean, because, so we're not, or I'm not, trying to, there's no way I could be at that craft level. Mm-hmm. Because of, you know, I go to techniques that I, that will help serve the content of my book, but there's no way I could be a master of each of those techniques. So I think part of maybe Florence's limit is that you have these extraordinary craftspeople, which, by the way, that's dying out, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But mm-hmm. So it's just, it's almost incompatible with this idea of the book art. It's sort of the craft. I mean, we're really trying to make art objects, as you said, not solely craft objects. And there's such a tradition of craft in Florence. It's almost like, yeah.
What you were saying also, I mean, I think it's something that maybe needs to be said for those who maybe aren't familiar with this whole kind of world of book arts. When we speak about our book works, they aren't necessarily what most people would think of as a book. You right. know, a book with two covers and pages that you turn. You know, we talked about earlier about one of our book works is in the shape of a game. Another one has this gigantic plant growing out of the spine.
You know, in paper.
In paper, yes. Not a real
paper plant. So
the forms in the world of book arts can take, you know, a myriad of different expressions. You know, it could be something that looks sort of like a traditional book. It could be something that looks completely different. The materials also can be so completely different. They don't always have to be paper and cardboard and things like that. It could be, you know, fabric. It could be, I had a student who made a book out of, you know, cold cuts. You know, you know, it could be so many different things. Right. So in America, I think, at least, you know, in certain circles, those things already are accepted or, you know, okay, we've seen those things or they can easily be introduced. In Italy, you know, you tell somebody you're a book artist, they expect to see a book with text and illustrations between two covers and you turn the pages. So it was very hard for us to... sometimes to share the things we were creating mm-hmm. with, mm-hmm. you know, the typical
yeah,
Italian.
I think they have an idea of more of a conceptually based codex format, mm-hmm. kind of out of maybe Arte Povera. Mm-hmm. And when they saw some of our books, it was sort of like, well, that reminds you of children's books.
Yes,
and it's
exactly.
true that, you know, a lot of children's book, book artists do employ a lot of children's book format. If you think of, I mean, yeah. again, the game, the envelope, book mm-hmm. or you know there are things that so that maybe they don't seem you know like we're taking it seriously enough for Italians or
yeah,
something
it's an interesting
you're yeah. Americans
yeah
but our games are dealing with organ transplantation for example so they're not right. light you know yeah. they're not light
yeah.
motifs
yeah exactly.
I think too I just when I speak about my work I really always have to start the talk with what is book art. People don't know and I realized that a couple years ago when I was giving a talk in Virginia at the Festival of the Book. They have a beautiful Festival of the Book there. Not book art, but of sort of trade books. But there is a little piece of book art as part of that festival. And I was sort of thinking about that talk, and I was talking to my parents, who I live now near my parents, and after 30 years.
In Virginia.
And my dad says, "So Lyle, what is book art?" I said, "Dad, oh gosh, Dad, I have been doing this now for years. I have an MFA in it." And you still are asking. You came to the MFA exhibit, and you still don't know what book art is. So I thought, okay, if my own dad is still asking me what is book art, I've got to first define it for folks I'm talking to. So I actually ended up writing a little skit, and my dad came to the talk, and I called him up, and we did the skit about what is book art. And he sort of asked these, not silly, but, you know, funny questions, and there's some, anyway, to make it, you know, not so heady as not so that people could make it accessible. So again, it's where kind of I think for me anyway as a fine art, I was a painter for many years and writer, and so it's the place that where those things can live, cohabitate, and all these other things can happen too. So the form, whether it's a zigzag book, you know, accordion book, or a pop up, or a box or a sculpture or all these other things can happen in the space that we call book art. And again, the range is as broad as the individual is making.
Yeah, we had talked about this one last night. We were talking at dinner about this, that both of us, Lyle kind of began her artistic career in painting. I was a graphic designer for many, many years. I was an art director for a magazine. And we both sort of, I think, gravitated toward book arts. And I think for both of us, it was this idea that you were allowed to do lots of different things. I mean, I tend to be very curious. I see a new technique. I see a bead maker. Oh, I need to learn how to make beads. I see a paper maker. I need to know how to make paper. Oh, weaving. I want to learn how to do weaving. You know, and all of it is justified because I can use it eventually in a book. Right? So it's like
found
I can
your way.
Learn. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but it's true. It's, you know, and for the 12 books, our collaboration of 12 books, I think one of the things that, at least for me, I really considered was I didn't want to repeat techniques. So in one technique, I used stitching. In another technique, we used paper cutting. In another technique, we used shadows. In another technique, you know, it was all, you know, allowed, which was great. For me, it was very liberating. And again, it gave me sort of the approval to be able to do all these different things that I wanted to learn.
So you're here specifically for your San Francisco event Thursday night. Can you talk a little bit about the exhibit and you're offering classes as well?
Yes, please come. There's work today, in fact. Tuesday, June 13th,4 to 6 p.m., yes. 4 to 6 p.m., we are offering a free workshop for teens, 13 to 18, on the second floor of the San Francisco Public Library main branch. And on Sunday, June 18th, a free workshop for adults from 2 to 4:30 p.m., and that, I believe, is in the lower level Latino room. Please come, and there's info on the website. I believe if you look up meeting places, San Francisco Public Library, you'll see how you can sign up for those workshops. You could also just show up, although we'd love to know how many numbers to prepare for. And on Thursday, June 15th, from 5 to 7, the library is holding an opening exhibit, or an opening reception. And at 6 p.m., again, lower level Latina room, we will be talking about a selection of works for maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes, something like that.
Very exciting. And how can a person find out more work and information about you both? Do you have a website? Do you have other information that you can? Maybe you will.
A page on my website exists about our work. So that's lyleharris.com/collaborations.
Okay. And I'll have that information on my website too.
Great. Fantastic. And so for now, that's where it's living. And we have several pieces of ephemera, publications that we will be sharing at the opening, and perhaps a catalog's in our future.
May, perhaps.
We've been too busy making books and having...
Exactly.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what's next?
That's the big question.
Yeah.
Well, we just editioned, actually, the book Paper Boats. Again, the original works were all an edition of two, so two copies, one for her, one for Lyle, one for myself. And now Paper Boats, we've just printed in Italy an edition of 150.
Thanks in part to a project assistance grant from the College Book Arts
Association.
CBAA.
Yes. Yeah. And we're talking about perhaps editioning another one or two of the books. So some of those things. So basically this project sort of lives on.
It lives on.
And then next, we don't know, because again, when we began, we were both living in Florence, and so it was a lot easier. Now, the distance, we even noticed with the 12 books, the last three books, Lyle was already back in the States, and it changed the dynamic, and it became a difference. So I think we both would be interested in doing more collaborations, but it's how to organize it now from a distance.
I think something there may be more to say about the nostalgia project.
Yes.
We have a lot of still objects and thoughts around that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I wrote a long piece entitled something like, I think it was 7,000 words, Why I'll Never Be Interviewed by Terry Gross on Book Art. And here you are dedicating a radio show to book art. I love that.
Wow, how fun.
One of the answers was because nobody knows what book art is. And here we are. So thank you for
it's definitely emerging. And I'm excited. I hope to go and just stay in touch with both of you to see what you do. And just thanks so much for coming to the show and talking about this great work that you're both sharing and experiencing. I mean, what I'm taking away from it is that I want to go home and collect all these valuable little things that I have which have no meaning to anybody except for myself, and create something from it to give it to new meaning. I don't know. It's very inspirational. Mm-hmm. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And sharing. And we're going to end the show with another song by Francesco Ronchetti.
Well, by the Trinovox.
By the Trinovox. Yeah. The band Trinovox.
Yep.
And this one is called Shir Hashirim. Did I have that correct? And this information will also be on my website, Take Back. And just thanks so much for joining us today. This is Take Back at 102.3 FM or radio.dominican.edu. We'll be back next week. No, not next week. I'm taking a break off. I'm going on some travel. So I'll be back the following week with David Herlocker, who is one of Marin County's legendary and wonderful, wonderful human beings who has really changed an entire generation. The way they hike in our hills and interact with botany and plants, and it's changed a few lives. He's a pretty special character in our Marin County here. So that'll be 2 weeks from today at 12 o'clock. And thanks so much for joining us. And we'll listen to some music, and we'll see you next time. Thank you, Lyle and Patricia. We'll see you next time, too.
Show. You a lot, and up in my head, I'm your boyfriend.